I have a friend that I work closely with who uses the term bell jar to talk about like an identity. So he says we all live in a bell jar, and the bell jar sort of represents the limits of how we see the world. And we're inside this bell jar, and we don't even know that we're in a bell jar, which is kind of crazy. And he says, when you get together with a group, it's like being at a bell jar ball. You know, you've got all these people running around in their own kind of ways of making sense of the world, and you've got to, and that creates a pretty complex system.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Role Models Podcast, the podcast where we host candid conversations with inspiring women about their personal journeys, career histories, and all the valuable lessons and learnings they've picked up along the way. My name is David Noel, and I'm one of the two co-founders of Role Models, an event and podcast series that I started with my friend and co-founder, Isabel. Our guest in this episode is an executive coach and specialist in the areas of leadership and adult development. Her name is Carolyn Coughlin, and with her organization called Cultivating Leadership, she and her colleagues help people and leaders grow, develop, and live as fully as they can. Carolyn started out her career working as a management consultant before finding her true passion, which lies in adult development. In today's conversation, Carolyn explains what adult development means. She shares with us many tools that she uses when she coaches executives at some of the world's best-known companies. This is a great episode if you want to learn how you can cultivate your own leadership style by asking yourself a series of questions and by taking perhaps different perspectives and seeing leadership as a series of habits that are self-reinforcing and potentially contagious. You'll also learn from Carolyn about what she calls her self-authored voice and to break and how to break the cycle of reinforcing feedback loops that might be holding you back at work. Big shout out to our patrons for this episode. As always, we have Megan Quinn, general partner at Spark, who supports the organization code 2040.org, and then Anna Carolina, who is a leadership coach based out of Berlin. You can find more about her work on truthcircles.com. If you want to become a patron yourself, you can do that by going to patreon.com/role models. Before we jump into this conversation, we could use your help. If you have time to rate and review this episode on iTunes or would like to share this episode on Instagram stories with your friend, you would do us a great favor. This is the Role Models Podcast. Thank you, as always, for listening, and enjoy this episode with Carolyn Coughlin. Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, David. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. And I want to share with our audience a little bit the reason why we're sitting here together virtually and recording this conversation. In front of me, I have a book. It's called Tribe of Mentors. And Tribe of Mentors is a compilation of about 100 people who answer between 2, 3, 11 questions by a man named Timothy Ferris, who I think a lot of listeners know because of his great podcast, The Tim Ferris Show, where he hosts long-form conversation like the one we have today. And in his book, one of those 100 people profiled in the book is a man named Graham Duncan. And he works at East Rock Capital, which is an investment firm. And in one of these questions, one of the questions that Tim asked Graham is, what is one of the most worthwhile investments that he has done over the course of his life and career? And there's in his answer, there's a name that popped up, and that's your name. And he said, Duncan said that you were one of the two coaches that he has worked with who has had an enormous impact on him. And that's something that I would love to dive into. And when I reached out to you with that story, you kindly agreed to come on a podcast because I wanted to know what it was, what kind of impact you've had on him. So in the answer that he gives in the book, where he talks about the work that he and you and him have done, he described you as the most gifted listener that he has ever encountered. And I want to stop there because listening is one of the topics and themes and skills that we talk a lot about on his podcast. So we have a question that I'll ask you also at the end of the podcast: what is one foundational skill that people recommend to practice and develop early on in their career? And And one answer that keeps coming back is listening. And so if you were teach me or teach anyone to become such a gifted speaker as Graham describes you, how and what would you teach me?
I guess the thing that I would say is that the key to really deep listening is curiosity. And curiosity is not a thing that you can just, it's not a skill that you can teach. It's a thing that develops as a result of, I think, of engaging in certain practices. So what I do, what we do, my firm, when we practice listening, is we actually put people into situations where someone says something to them that is really hard to hear. And then, and I do this with my coaching clients too, just one-on-one, and then notice what comes up for you. So when somebody says to me something like, you know, Carolyn, you're not spending enough time with your kids, I get to notice that how that feels to me. And then what is the thing I want to say? So first you have to notice what happens for you as the listener, and then learn to take a pass on that, and then be curious about what might be going on for the other person that's leading them to say the thing that they're saying. So it's about taking the attention, noticing how much I want to protect myself, and then shift my attention from that to the other person and ask myself the question, what might be going on for that person that would lead them to say or ask that thing? So that's when there's tension in a conversation, but which is the harder time to listen. And when you're listening, like say in a coaching situation or just to, you know, casual conversation, the key really is to just be curious and to constantly ask yourself that question, what might be going on for that person? Or what does that person mean by that?
What are some so curiosity is at the core there from what I hear, and then the second thing he said that you taught him to ask better questions, and I think you already alluded to some of them, like what is going on there, like what is this person feeling right now, like what's the underlying dynamic going on. So how have you practiced over your time as a coach to become good at asking questions?
So I tend to think of it as not asking better questions, but asking different questions. So some questions are more suited to a particular situation than others. But the thing that I try to keep in mind and I talk with my clients about is that the questions that we ask precede the information that we have, right? So the questions that we ask lead to the information that we get. So if the information that we have or the way that we're making sense of something isn't working, like maybe it's keeping us stuck, you know, in a particular pattern with another person, or maybe it's keeping us stuck in a job we don't like, if the questions that we're asking are giving us certain answers, if we want different information, we have to ask a different question. So one of the practices I do with myself and with my clients is to have people notice, what questions are you actually asking, both explicitly and implicitly? So, for example, if I have a client who's constantly thinking somebody else is out to get her or him, we look at that and we say, what question are you asking? And often the question is, who's to blame? So then we pose a different question.
So it sounds like, and I've experienced this as well as a coachee, but also sometimes when I use the coaching method and then my time as a manager or now as a consultant, is that most often the answers are already in people, and it's all about guiding them to the answer, to that answer that's within them, by asking the right questions, or as you said, asking the different questions. Can you make sense of this, why we have those answers in us, but it takes a guide or a coach or sometimes a therapist to get us to leading us there? What's going on there?
Well, I have one hypothesis. It's probably many things, but one hypothesis I have is that I mean, most of us have probably heard about confirmation bias. And so we, even if we don't like the answers that we're getting, for most of us, there's something in the way that we see things or see ourselves in the world that's has worked for us. So we form these habits of asking questions that get us the predictable answers. And even if an objective person could look at the situation and say, this isn't working, we're in such a habit of doing that, that, and so we have this confirmation bias that if we ask particular questions, we'll get particular answers that we're at least comfortable with, even if it doesn't work that well. So so we get in this kind of reinforcing feedback loop of, and it's not conscious mostly, of if I ask this question, I'll get this answer, and it works, and we keep doing it.
And how have you found that this is the kind of work that you want to do, right? You mentioned that you were in management consulting and at some point decided that that this is not for you, but there's something else in there. What was the transition from this more corporate setup to the world you're in now, where you work as an executive coach and as a facilitator and work with clients like Graham and many others? Like, what compelled you to go into coaching, to become a coach?
I'm going to give you another, it was kind of an accident answer, but the story is that this kind of goes back to the thing you just said, that we often, all of us have the answers in us, and sometimes we just need something external to shift before we can notice. So what happened for me was that I was, being a management consultant was reinforcing my kind of identity as a person who could do, you know, if I just put my mind to it, I could do it. I could, and I was getting my joy from the kind of pushing myself and being this kind of achiever, you know, trying to do something really hard and mostly being able to do it, although not always as well as I wanted. And I had, I did that for several years, and then I was going to have my first child, and I had been looking for things to do in my same company that wouldn't require me to travel so much. And at the same time, my husband got a new job and we moved. So I found in my same company, I found a job kind of by accident that was not a consulting role, but that was working with supporting consulting teams. So as a kind of a team coach. And I knew inside me that's what I was really good at and that's what I loved and gave me joy. But it was this external thing that happened that that prompted me to actually do it.
How did you know that you were really good at it?
Well, at the time I knew I was good at it because people told me that I was good. I got positive feedback. You know, I was in my early 30s at the time. And yeah, people said, gee, Carolyn, you're really good at that. You're really good at this. And a couple key people told me that. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe if they say I am, I must be.
So it sounds like feedback is the reinforcing feedback is the, was a driver there for you realizing this. And speak a little bit about feedback. And is there a way to actively go out and seek feedback and input to determine or to learn that that someone wants to make a shift in a career or actually unlock something that they hadn't seen before when it comes to shifting roles or shifting careers?
So you're asking if for sort of tips on how people can get the feedback that's going to be useful to them?
Correct.
Is that right? You're asking questions that I keep giving you these. I feel like I'm giving you these not direct answers because that's a big question. I guess the simple answer is just, you know, tell people that feedback is helpful and go ask for it. And, you know, in corporate cultures and organizational cultures, there's a lot of training on how to give and receive feedback. And I think the intention of that is to make it more, it is to kind of shape the path or make it more likely that people will do that. So that's one move for sure, that, you know, we encourage it and then we create the conditions for it to happen well by training people to do it well. But I think my experience is that feedback is a really personal thing. And again, it has to do a little bit, I think, maybe with things like Myers-Briggs type. It has, I think, a lot to do with our stage of development and how we make sense of ourselves. Like at a kind of later stages, maybe beyond what I would call the self-authoring stage, that most people in that stage are really, really seeking feedback because they're on this self-improvement journey. And if you give me feedback, that's information for me that I can use to sort of strengthen my personal ideology and become better at what I do. But it's a mindset thing about feedback, because if I see feedback as a threat to my well-being, then I'm not going to want it, even if you tell me I should want it. There's a kind of simple answer, and then there's the more complex answer.
Yeah, it sounds like it's and I read a post about this the other day, which is actually a working paper developed by the Harvard Business School. And they went and looked at, they did a study and looked at people and how organizations give each other feedback. And what they found is that the people ask about the feedback tend to redefine their social network based on the type of feedback they get. So in other words, if people receive negative feedback, they reassemble or reshift or reestablish their network around themselves to in favor for positive feedback. Whereas I think for people who are taking constructive feedback as a good way to unfold blind spots, or as a way to receive information on where they can grow and develop, it's funny how we react to negative or constructive feedback as a threat rather than seeing it as an opportunity. So it's I found this really interesting that people actively go and rebuild their social network around positive feedback only.
I would wonder if you did a study of the difference between people that reshape their social network to essentially avoid negative feedback versus the people who didn't do that, what you would find about them, both developmentally. I mean, developmental lens is just one lens, but you might also find that they had different kinds of upbringings or different different conditioning. So, for example, one of the key things, I believe, in encouraging feedback, a feedback-rich environment, is not only giving people the skills to do it skillfully with each other, but it's also to have an environment where there is a true kind of blend of stretching, where people stretch each other and they believe that that's that's normal and that's good, and also that they support each other. So this combination of stretch and support is so critical for a feedback-rich environment. I mean, I've been in environments that were kind of toxically feedback. I was going to say feedback-rich, but I would give it another word.
Feedback poor.
Feedback destructive. Yeah.
So I want to talk about leadership, because that's a big reason why I reached out to you initially, and also because of your desire and your passion of encouraging more women to take on leadership positions. But maybe before we jump into that topic, you work as an executive coach, so a coach for executives. You work as a specialist in the development of leaders and their leadership capabilities. Can you describe a little bit, like, a typical, or maybe there's no typical reason why a leader would, an executive would seek your help or to work with you as a coach? But can you give a bit of an insight into the kind of work you do with leaders in your day in, day out?
Sure. Yeah. I am an executive coach, and I at the moment, I probably only spend about a third of my time in one-on-one coaching, and the rest of my work is working with groups of leaders. So I'll focus on the one-to-one coaching first. There is no typical, but I would say that an executive would almost always ask for seek developmental coaching when they in some way feel like they're in over their heads. So I have a client, a woman who is the CEO of a family-owned biotech company, and I would describe her as a reluctant leader. She loves a challenge, and she's really up for it, and she really cares about the product pipeline a lot, really cares a lot about it. But I think she would be just as happy. She doesn't see herself as a leader. But here she finds herself leading a small but rapidly growing company. And she, you know, she's got this sense, as many women do, that she doesn't know what the heck she's doing. And so that's why she came to me initially. I knew her from years ago. But so there's one example. I have another guy who is a, you know, leading a start. Actually, there's a pretty typical, now that I'm saying it, is a pretty typical profile that they find themselves faced with context kind of out in their environment, things that are, they're facing that are more complex than what they have ever addressed before. And they're looking for support.
So can you talk a bit about the difference between, you said you spend about a third of your time doing coaching leaders one-on-one and then the rest of it in groups. What's the difference in working with a leader one-on-one versus a group of leaders?
Well, there are lots of differences, of course. The one is that in one-on-one coaching, you can try to really target the conversations and the work that they do to their specific developmental, wherever they are developmentally. In a group, you have to actually create what I would call developmentally spacious interventions. I'm doing an intervention. We teach programs about leadership, but we do a lot of working with senior teams as well. And I'm working with a senior team coming up where there's clearly a range of both, you know, Myers-Briggs types, histories, developmental stages. So it's important to create the conditions for everyone to get something out of it if you can, and to be really flexible to what's happening in the room in the moment. I think that's the hardest part about working with groups, is being really, really aware to the multiple things that are going on. It's like I have a friend that I work closely with who uses the term bell jar to talk about like an identity. So he says we all live in a bell jar, and the bell jar sort of represents the limits of how we see the world. And we're inside this bell jar, and we don't even know that we're in a bell jar, which is kind of crazy. And he says when you get together with a group, it's like being at a bell jar ball. You know, you've got all these people running around in their own kind of ways of making sense of the world, and that creates a pretty complex system.
That's a good image. We have so the idea of a leader, right? And maybe as a backdrop for this, to jump into it as well, to just look at the qualities or the idea that we have of a leader, is that when I speak with people around in my immediate social network, people who work in organizations, and this can be startup companies or established more mature companies or even corporates. The thing I keep hearing is that there's a lot of complaint about individual leaders or the concept of leadership. There's an old form of leadership, whatever that means. If you think about the world we live in today, and you mentioned, you know, that one of the constants that we have is that we live in a very complex world and an ever increasingly complex world, but also world of business. What is it from your perspective and vantage point? What is the idea of a modern leader? And I don't think modern is the right word, but what has changed over the last maybe 5 to 10 years when we think about leaders? And why is it so hard to assume a leadership position, and why are we so hard on leaders?
That's a great series of questions. So what is my view of kind of a modern leader, and how is it different? Why is it so hard, and why are we so hard on them? Those are the questions?
Yeah, sorry for giving you three questions in
no,
one.
No, it's all right. So I guess the the easiest distinction that I can give is that we are living in a complex world. We always have been. It's just that two things. One is, I don't think that most leaders and organizations had a language to make sense of the idea of complexity. Also, things are just moving so much more quickly and are so much more interconnected. So whatever complexity there was is just magnified. So that, you know, what makes sense today or solution today might make no sense literally tomorrow, because things change so much in unexpected ways. So the definition of leader I grew up with was kind of a heroic leader. And even through business school, again, I don't know if this is what my professors intended or whether it's just what I heard because of where I was at the time, but leaders are supposed to know everything. Leaders are charismatic, like Jack Welch. Leaders are really smart. They must have gone to, you know, Wharton or HBS or something like that. And they have the answers, and they can see the future, and they can make things happen. So why are we so hard on our leaders? Because that's impossible. And that there's a way that we look at our political leaders. We expect them to have all the answers as well. And one of the key shifts that we try to make in our work, both in one-on-one coaching and in groups, is to help people shift their sort of the model of leadership that they think about from heroic to adaptable. I tend to talk about complex adapted leadership. And that leader, the complex adapted leader, doesn't have all the answers, admits that they don't, but that doesn't make them weak, because they still have to be really, really good at holding the space for the unknown. They have to be able to communicate that that they are doing something, that they're moving in a particular direction. They have to be able to be open to the constant shifting and absorb a lot of the day-to-day unpredictability that's happening on behalf of their people, but not to shield people from complexity. So it is a really, really tricky job. But in some ways, it's actually liberating. Stanley McChrystal wrote a book called Team of Teams, which I find to be one of the
great book. Yeah.
I mean, I read that book after we had been doing this, you know, developing leaders for complexity for years. And he just put language and examples to it that I found really useful. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah. So we'll add it in the show notes. This is General McChrystal, right? Stanley McChrystal, Team of Teams. Really good. The work that you do and the organization that you work with is called Cultivated Leadership. And so we introduced now the concept of leadership and the change between what the idea or the image of a leader was when you went to school and how it is today in an ever increasing complex interconnected world. How do you then cultivate leadership as a competency, right? So we have the organizations that I've worked with in the last 10 years were startup companies where a typical path would be that an individual contributor, because of the fast growth of the organization, somehow ends up having a team, managing a team, being considered as a leader, being designated as a leader, having expectations put onto them of starting to lead. Sometimes that person can assume that that leadership position and whatever and everything that comes with it. And sometimes a person would find that it's very difficult for them to do this. So leadership as a way or cultivating leadership, like how can you take someone like me, who used to be an individual contributor, and then suddenly find myself turn around and I'm a VP leading a team of 25 people. How do you cultivate leadership in me?
You're asking really hard questions, David.
Thank you.
I actually love the word cultivate, and that was quite intentional, because when you're dealing with complex challenges, which growing leaders is a complex challenge, right? It doesn't happen overnight, and there's a lot of moving parts, including identities and fears and context out there and all that. So leadership is an emergent property of a complex system, I would say. So you can't just hand somebody a bottle of leadership, as you well know from your own experience, I'm guessing, and say, you're a leader now, just as you can't hand somebody a bottle of trust or collaboration or any of those things. Those are all emergent properties. So cultivating is like, you know, it implies planting seeds, tilling the soil, watering. So what are the seeds that you plant? How do you till the soil? How do you water in kind of real life? So when I think about that, I think about teaching skills that are both immediately useful and also developmental in nature. So teaching people how to listen to each other deeply, for example, is immediately useful because it helps people to be open to feedback. Teaching people how to communicate a message through the pyramid principle, for example, for those of you who have been management consultants, in a very structured way, it is an immediately useful skill, but it also helps you to organize your thoughts in a way that is developmental, because it helps you see the bigger picture in a way, not just the tactical stuff. So it's about teaching skills like listening, like offering your perspective in a clear but powerful way, teaching skills like polarity management, which some of you might be familiar with, but it's a way to see interconnected things that seem like they're completely different and the ways that they're interconnected. That's a framework that has very, very useful, immediate impact when you have a team that's stuck, for example, and they're polarized. But it's also developmental because it helps people to see a bigger system and how things are interconnected. So I know it's probably a very unsatisfying answer, but the bottom line is I think of it as offering skills that are immediately useful. And we think of this as a firm this way too, cultivating leadership, and that are also developmental in nature if practiced over time, so that by the time you become a leader of multiple people, you have the ability to, for example, get on the balcony and see multiple perspectives without being torn apart by it. You have the ability to take a system view of things. You have the ability to ask different questions and listen deeply. So
you describe on the website as well that for you it's about the work that you do with your colleagues is to make great leadership a habit. Can you talk about more about leadership as a habit?
I think of it as leadership as a series of habits that together give rise to this emergent thing called leadership. So we all have habits. It's a question of whether we notice them or not. So first we have to notice our habits, and then we have to notice which ones maybe aren't serving the purpose that we want them to serve, and then develop new habits, which really can only come with practice. And that's where a habit forms when kind of intellectual knowledge becomes embodied, where we just do it. So I think leadership is a series of habits that we intentionally cultivate.
Can you unpack a bit a few of those series of habits? Like what are habits of a great leader?
Well, the ones that we think about at Cultivating Leadership that really span everything, so they're pretty high level, are these three habits of mine that were developed by my partners Jennifer and Keith many years ago. And they are, we've talked about all of them already, asking different questions, taking multiple perspectives, and seeing systems. So another habit which I think is really, really important, and it's not totally separate to the other three, it is developing the habit of listening to our bodies, because our bodies are a great source of information that most people just aren't used to. But that can be developed.
How do you do that? Like how do you start using your body as a great way to become a leader, to improve your leadership?
Well, first this is where a coach or somebody else comes in really handy, because just having somebody to ask you the question. So let's say I'm talking to you, let's say you're my colleague or my coach, and I'm really angry about something. It's really easy for me to just get in a loop about being angry and thinking I can sort of just fix it somehow by doing something differently. But if you ask me, you know, where do I feel that anger in my body, then I have the split second to notice, like, is my breath short? Is my chest tight? Are my fists clenched? Something like that. My jaw clenched, maybe. And then I can do two things. I can begin to notice earlier when this thing called anger is coming up, because actually my body is doing something before the feeling or thought of anger arises. So develop a habit of noticing. And then if I can notice that, then I have a whole different set of choices about what I do in that moment of anger. So if I notice what's happening in my body, and my fists are clenched, I can actually unclench my fists and then see if a different thought or feeling arises. It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, this is really great, because it reminds me a bit on scanning the body when you meditate, right? It's a bit like being more aware of how the body feels, but it's not in a, in meditation, it would be in a very relaxed state of mind, hopefully, but the way you describe it is like in the action to start to become aware of it. That's a really great tip. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. I want
to talk to you about a passion of yours, and it's the initial reason why I reached out to you. And I remember, I think it was even the subject line of my email when I reached out to you. And it is your passion about encouraging more women to take on leadership positions. And I know this is a topic that has been talked about a lot in the media, and it's, you know, with the Me Too movement and, the recent political environment in the US particularly, but also in other places in the world. Can you talk a little bit about how you see your view generally around the imbalance of the gender imbalance in leadership positions?
Yeah, I have a couple of pet theories about this, which I don't in any way suggest are right or all inclusive. But there are two things that are related, three things actually. So they are, there's how we make sense of the idea of power. So that's one. Secondly, it has to do with confidence. And there is a lot, there's some pretty good studies that talk about the ways confidence shows up between men and women and how that's different. And the third is back to this adult development idea of developing the capacity to make sense of ourselves through the lens of a self-authored voice, as opposed to making sense of ourselves through the context that we're in. And they're closely related. But my sense is that women in general, the ones I know, have a slight aversion, for the most part, to the idea of power, partly because power brings to mind sort of a power over idea. And women, again, this is generally not all inclusive, but women generally are wired for connection, so with others, a little bit more so than women. It's really important to us. And so the idea of being a person who would have power over another person is, for many women that I know, myself included, an unattractive idea. So we might want to, if we've been, you know, gone to lots of years of school and we've been encouraged to climb the ladder, we might want to do that. But in any given moment, when given the choice of having to assert some sort of power, like put ourselves above other people, it can be really hard for women to do that. And this is related to the adult development idea that when we look outside ourselves for role models or examples of what power looks like, what we often see is a kind of power that doesn't look or feel very good to us. So as long as we're looking outside ourselves, which most of us are up until at least our early 30s, for how to know who we are and how to know what the world looks like, then we see these examples of power that don't look attractive to us, that really puts us in a bind.
How do you then work with women in particular to encourage them to take on leadership positions?
So it's not so much that I wouldn't think of myself as specifically encouraging women to take on leadership positions. What I try to do is to help women develop the capacity in themselves to do that. And part of it is shifting the way they make sense of things. So their assumptions about the world. So let's say a woman, one of my women clients might say, I could never, well, I had one say this yesterday, I could never blow up at somebody in a meeting. I could never do that, no matter how angry I am. And she had just told me a story about how one of her male colleagues had done that very thing. Now, I'm not encouraging blowing up in meetings. It's usually not that useful. But when a thing is completely off limits, I could never do that because that would be, I might hurt somebody, or what would that look like, or who would I be if I did that? If that option of losing your temper or raising your voice a lot in a meeting is off limits, then that really constrains what you can do. And my sense is that for many women, the idea of stepping into power requires some of those behaviors and ways of being in the world that are unattractive to them. So you asked the question, how do I do that? I help them uncover some of their assumptions and then begin to question them and ask different questions about that.
What can companies do to support that process, right? It sounds a little bit like if the leader in question, if the woman leader in question can come and work with you on that, that's a really great condition, or it's a really good setup to have. But for people listening to this, what advice could you share for them to influence their organizations or their companies to make their environment a place where women can, where these assumptions can be removed and women can develop their own leadership capabilities?
Another tough question. when I was in corporate world for many years before I was working on my own, I lived through many efforts by different companies to make the workplace more attractive and more comfortable for women. And none of the things actually, you know, were the silver bullet. Nothing was. So I would say, first of all, that companies, if they view this as a complex issue, they have a lot better chance of making progress than if they view it as something, an issue to which there is a solution if they could only find it and implement it perfectly. So complexity suggests that you try lots of little things. And you just keep nudging, and there is never a there. There's never victory. There's just continuing to create conditions in the organization. So what are some of those conditions? I work with a company right now that that is so achievement focused and such tight timelines on delivering results that it makes it uncomfortable for everybody. So there's this, the focus is always on what can I deliver? What can I deliver? What can I deliver? And even though failure is talked about as an okay thing, and it is in some ways, failure also carries a very, very high price when it comes to how much you take home, how much pay you get. And so, so one thing I think is to whether it's through the performance pay or whether it is through how often they do review cycles, companies do review cycles, to make short-term failure much more palatable for people. And I think this would help everybody. But women in particular, I think, have a hard time with that because they have, for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons being that we have so many, women in generally have many more responsibilities outside of work. Now, that's changing, but it hasn't changed completely. Mm. So just creating more space for people to fail in the short term, and I think is one. There's one for you.
One of the things that I was always inspired by during my time at SoundCloud, when we saw the emergence of employee-organized resource groups around questions around diversity and inclusion, was that what I found is that those groups, as a collective, like by pooling their energy and their passion around a certain topic, for example, more women in leadership positions, is that the pressure needs to come from the bottom, and the top needs to be open to addressing that pressure, right? And hopefully meet in the middle and make some implement some conditions to drive positive change. And so this is one of the things that we keep hearing sometimes in our live events that we have here in Berlin, is this people from the audience asking questions around, for example, I and others care about making more women leaders in the company, but we aren't being heard, or it doesn't seem to be important to management or to the CEO. So what advice can you share from the work you've done around increasing that pressure from the bottom, and how people can organize and maybe influence leadership or executives or CEOs in a meaningful and effective way, so that from the top there comes this idea of like, yeah, you are right, we need to change this, we need to drive changes, and we need to listen, and we need to be open to it. What can people do to increase the pressure from the bottom?
I keep thinking of all these kind of simple, what simple things can be done, having. I'm sort of stuck here because what I'm really, I think, actually, that things won't change unless there's a real reason to change. And so all of us have these kind of immunities to change about when we say we want to do something differently. Like, my guess is the senior leadership of these companies does actually want more women in leadership, at least at one level. It's the right thing to do. They're missing out on a huge, huge perspective when they don't have enough women in leadership. They're losing young women who leave because they don't have any senior role models. So my guess is it's not that they don't want change. It's that it's in those kind of smaller decisions that get taken on an ongoing basis where they probably don't even realize that they're acting in ways, the senior leadership, acting in ways that actively work against what the direction they're trying to take the company in terms of more women in leadership. So until there is a reason to change that's greater than the reason to stay the same, I'm not sure that much will change. The thing that I've been working with is in my work with younger women is to help individual younger women, individually and in groups, to develop more of a what I would call self-authored voice, so that they can manage the complexities of their own lives in the context of an environment that's putting impossible demands on them. And I have some hope in the fact that I see this younger generation standing up for themselves. And so I'm sorry that I'm not offering you specific ways, and maybe it's not that hopeful, but I think it's just bigger than specific things.
No, it's been really hopeful to see, to watch how things are changing and how actually the pressure is rising across the board. We're moving into the last segment because we're going to have to let you go in a few minutes. And I want to finish with three questions that we ask all of our guests on the podcast. And the first one would be, and we talked a little bit about skills already, but I'd be interested to know your perspective on what do you think are three foundational skills that anyone should master or acquire and develop and then eventually master over time that they can start off with earlier in their career. And those are skills that can be used over the course of their career, regardless of job and sector.
So the first one is learning to communicate your perspective in a way that is compelling and easily understandable. You probably thought I was going to start with listening, and it is a critical skill. And I believe that if each of us from early on can't communicate our perspective in a way that is clear, compelling, and also open, that it's very, very hard for us to have much influence. And I think this is particularly true for women. The second one is listening. In cultures where people listen to each other, there's more room for collective and individual growth and development. And the third one, this is not a skill, I'm going to cheat a little bit here, but it's learn to surround yourself with people who will both stretch you and support you. So look for those communities or friendships or colleagueships where people won't just let you rest on your laurels. They will stretch you, but they will also support you.
This is a great one. And it leads into a good next one. And so this is called the Role Models Podcast. And I was wondering, and you mentioned role models already in our conversation. Do you have role models yourself? And if so, who are they? And what is it that they do?
Most of my role models are my friends. They're my girlfriends. I don't have any role models kind of out there in the world. There are some people that I look up to, but if you had asked me this question 10 years ago, I probably would have told you some famous people or people from history. But right now, my role models are mostly my girlfriends and my colleagues, because these are people who do that thing of stretch and support. And this is going to sound really cliche, but my other role models are my kids. I have three teenagers, and one of them is 20 now. And I just watch the way these kids navigate the world in a way that is just so beautiful. And I take a lot of inspiration from that.
Great answer. This is the last question. Thank you so much for taking the time. What is the one single best piece of advice that you would give to your 14-year-old self?
I guess what I would say is to know, and I do give this, I have given this to my kids. I wish I had given it to my 14-year-old self, but to just know that the way you see yourself and the world right now is enough. It's exactly where you should be. And it's not the way that the world is always going to look to you, that view will grow and grow and grow, and hang on for the ride.
This is a beautiful answer to end on. Thank you so much, Carolyn, for taking the time to speak with us today and to the Role Models community. Where can people find you if you want to send people to learn more about you and your work and some of the things you've written? Where do you want to point people to?
Most of the things that I've written are on our website, Cultivating Leadership. So it's cultivatingleadership.com. We also have a sub business as part of Cultivating Leadership called Growth Edge Coaching, and we have a different website, growthedgecoaching.com, and that's where you'll read about things that are related to the coaching programs that we do and our thoughts about coaching.
Excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to speaking with us today, and all the best to you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thanks to Carolyn for sharing her story and the many insights on how you can cultivate your own leadership style. If leadership is a topic that you would like to hear more about, then why don't you check out this episode number 27 of the Role Models Podcast, where we interview Facebook's Vice President of Product Design, and her name is Margaret Stewart. And we talk a lot about the area of leadership. This episode was produced by me, David Noel, with the help of our editor, Kate Lewin. There are a few ways that you can support the creation of this podcast if you like. You can share this episode with your followers on Instagram stories or on Twitter. We're at _role models on Instagram and at role models on Twitter. You can rate and review this episode on iTunes, or you can become a patron of this podcast on patreon.com/role models. As always, thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. And until next time.